expression that he would take on the, he would go for the right identities, but when the imam is identified in front of him, he will toe the line.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the unique aspect of Shia leadership, isn't it?
Indeed.
As opposed to any other school.
Indeed,
of thought.
But in towing the line, it did not mean that you ignored what's happening around you.
No.
He was always observant what is happening around him,
sure,
to the extent that when the Shah was introducing various obnoxious political rulings, he firmly announced his opposition to it.
And we did mention that in the previous program in terms of the background that we were talking about. Although this was happening on the one hand, that we are talking about the migration of Imam Khomeini's family, may God bless him, you know, this very religious family, as you say, from a very pure line coming from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. From the seventh Holy Imam. We mentioned that. And we were looking at the aspect that, you know, at the same time, there were big, big changes happening in Iran in terms of its politics, in terms of its monarchical system that was here in Iran. And we were talking about the weakness of the Qajar dynasty. You know, we were talking about how the British, manipulated them and led them eventually to their downfall. And then we were talking about the constitutional movement, which was very important at the earlier 20th century, where this was a movement really to restore the rights of the people, because they were oppressed under the previous system. Indeed. But again, the British, through tricks and through ruse, because the clergy supported the constitutional movement in the respect that, you know, the rights that were taken away from the people could be restored to them. But through, again, the devil trickery of the British, they hijacked that constitutional movement, pretty much what we are beginning to see now with the Islamic awakening as well.
Yes.
It's a very, very dangerous time. Indeed. Where the powers tend to manipulate the passions of the people.
Indeed.
But, of course, the clergy, you know, were still at the forefront to try and restore those rights. And, you know, the British hijacked it, being the power of the time, hijacks it. And then we get to see, by 1920, you know, this, you know, commander in the Iranian army under the Qajar dynasty, Reza Khan, who seems to be the prime candidate for the British.
A Cossack,
yeah,
private,
exactly.
In reality, originally. Yes,
he was a very low-ranking guy, but the British had a talent for finding such people, and they found that he was, you know, fit to the purpose of trying to dismantle the Islamic character of Iran. And this is the background we are talking about here.
Indeed.
In terms of the clergy's resistance to this individual, as well as to the coup, basically, which brought Reza Khan to power.
Indeed, you see, the main important thing that we see in this kind of build-up that you're doing,
yes,
is that whilst Imam Khomeini is observing these changes, he's not ignoring the fact that he too needs to be Islamically and religiously educated to elevate himself to be a confrontation to these people.
No.
You know, he never confronted them in a non-religious way.
No.
All his arguments were purely religiously dominated confrontations. You know, in fact, from the age when he went to the Hawza to about 1962, he's purely developing his Islamic academic status in the community.
Exactly.
Within the ulema ranking, he's getting identified as a competent alim-e din.
Exactly.
You know, when Ayatollah Hayri takes the madrasa from Iraq to Qom, Ayatollah Hayri actually invites Imam Khomeini over because he knows that Imam Khomeini is a very learned youngster of that age, of that time.
I mean, this is a thing we have to point out to our listeners, of course, that Imam Khomeini, is not, we're not building up Imam Khomeini in a character in terms of, you know, some kind of historical context. We're doing it on the fact that, you know, he has merit right from from the beginning.
Indeed, and his merits are seen by the fact that, as you pointed out in our last session, that Imam Khomeini, not only did he become an expert in religious fields, but he also became experts in other areas of learning.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, he was his depth of understanding of Eastern and Western philosophy was far beyond. And you see, what is really interesting, a lot of people put Imam Khomeini's understanding at that time as being one of pure mysticism and Irfani understanding. Or he doesn't neglect the fact that he has developed in a mystical environment of mysticism because he had some very learned scholars of Irfan.
Well, I mean, we have to point out to the fact to our listeners that, you know, Islamic studies is a very comprehensive form of study. I mean, if you go to the Hawza, you are required to learn, different sciences, from, Hadith sciences to Quranic sciences, to learning about fiqh, about jurisprudence. You know, you're also required to learn, as you say, about Irfan. And Imam Khomeini spent 6 years of his life studying those aspects.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to bring home in this point is that he did not just become a hermit.
No, that's right.
What he did with his Islamic awareness, because this is very important to understand, at the moment, the world is trying to create a vacuum of religious practitioners.
Yeah. You know, we're talking like the Sufis, for example.
It's ideal that you do become religious and sit in one corner and practice your own religion. Imam Khomeini did not extrapolate that from his learnings.
No.
What he decided was that he was going to build himself, elevate him towards God, but not on his own. He was going to elevate his society to take with him.
Well, he points out something that's very, very important for the Muslim Ummah in terms of what you're saying there, because he points out the fact that if you want true success in terms of guiding the Ummah, to take the real, because we are really talking about taking the mantle of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his whole family. Because, of course, in this day and age, we are in the age of the occultation. We don't have an infallible to guide the Imam. So we have to have, as Imam Khomeini says, we have to have something in between that we have gained from our infallible Imams to guide the Ummah at all times and at all in all situations. And what you're pointing out is such a fundamental and basic point in Islam, which, as you say, the Imam Khomeini embodies in a sense in his personality and his character, that he is saying that, we've got to do away with the ego and everything must be for Allah's sake. And if you do that, you're going to find the formula for success in guiding the Ummah, because he's got no personal ambition whatsoever.
And you see, this is why he becomes really the subject of this ayat as well. That, whilst the people the ayat is saying, don't forget, you will be called on that day with your Imam.
Yeah.
So he's saying, look, Imam Khomeini is saying if a Muslim leadership wants to be close to God, it should be such that he will be counted in this ayat and people would be dashing with him to be counted with him on the day of judgment.
Exactly.
So in other words, the aspiration, we have an ayat in the Quran which we read in the Qunut of every Salat. We say, Rabbana atina fid dunya hasana wa fil akhirati hasana. In the sense that we're saying, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, grant me the goodness in this world and the goodness in the hereafter. So, we're not telling people just become a hermit and sit in the corner and just do om, and pray that the idols of shaitaniyat will elevate us to the day of judgment.
Because in that hasana, we are also talking about this adherence to the walaya.
Indeed. And you see, what Imam Khomeini has done in his passing of time till 63, particularly, 1963, is that he's observing the things which are destroying the hasana of the community.
Yes.
You look at what Imam Khomeini had observed in his time.
Yes.
He was observing that certain changes in the constitution which were going to destroy the pure nature of the Muslim community.
Exactly.
One of the things that the Shah was trying to promote was that he was going to allow non-Muslims to enter politics and make Muslim decisions without even taking an oath on the Quran, without taking an oath on any religious book. In other total disobedience
total
to the Creator.
Total blasphemies in terms of religion.
And the other thing which really jolted Imam Khomeini's attitude towards the Shah was that they were about to pass, in fact, they were in the process of passing the law, and the law was enforced for a while, that, if an American murdered anybody in England or Iran. That person would not be judged under Iranian laws. He would be taken to America and judged under American law.
Yeah.
So, there's that total decapitation of Islamic values, distortion and total abortion or removal of that which
would... This is what we have to point out to our listeners, that the background in which, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, may God bless him, is acquiring his Islamic knowledge, supporting the Hawza, supporting the leadership of the... And I was thinking of Ayatollah Mudarris, because Ayatollah Mudarris was at the forefront of the resistance against Reza Khan's blasphemies
and
in the
martyred
face of Sharia.
For it.
Yeah, he was martyred. Yes, of course, he was martyred at the end. But, this is what we are pointing out, that, Imam Khomeini is not doing something out of the blue here.
Indeed,
he's doing it in a context in which there is great leadership in amongst the Shia who are at the forefront of the resistance to what Raza Khan was doing.
And you see, the educational system was being destroyed.
Destroying.
Mixed was education being was being
he
generated.
Said, namaz was banned.
Yes.
The Holy Quran could no longer be studied in school.
Hijab was destroyed.
Hijab had to be removed. Things like this. I mean, in a Muslim country, in an Islamic country, I mean, for centuries, you know, you have, you know, the Shia tradition that was established, you know, during the time of the Safavis, and he's removing all that.
Yeah, but I you mean, see that what was happening is that these lawmakers were looking at all these in the same perspective as Atatürk was in Turkey.
That's right. Yes.
They were trying
to
look at it in a kind of changing world, improving society. But in reality, the aspirations were to destroy the Islamic nature of the society.
Exactly. I mean, this is what the British and the Russians were looking
and
for.
And you see, Imam Khomeini, in his depth of Islam that he understood, he was able to say, you can have advancement in Islamic society without abandoning Islamic values. That is what he stood for, ultimately, when he...
That's right.
When the confrontation... Because, you see, you've got to remember, again, bringing back home the fact that Imam Khomeini was really well-read in Islamic concepts.
That's right.
So well-read that he was able to articulate those theories into a practical form for the public in the early, kind of mid-late 20th century, 1960s, 1970s. He was articulating all those religious values that he had put into him from the Hawza.
That's right. I mean, he was a murja taqlid, an expert in his own right. By the 1940s, there's works that are coming out from him. You know, he's writing books on, you know, the rituals of prayer, which is a more mystical type of book. He's writing the traditions of Imam Raza. He's restoring and commenting on those aspects. And you know, by the 1940s, he's really an expert in his own right. But he's still under the stewardship of Ayatollah Borojerdi, because while he is the man who is at the head of the Hawza system, you know, he's still the student.
And you see, until 1962, early 1963, Imam Khomeini is just putting himself to teaching and experiencing. Because again, with Ayatollah Borojerdi's position, Imam Khomeini did not stop giving his lectures in Fezziah, for example.
That's right.
You know, against Shah's position, and thereby not confronting Ayatollah Borojerdi, but in fact complimenting the strength of the ulema.
That's
He would not say, even in his speeches, he would say Shah this, Shah that. He wouldn't say Ayatollah Borojerdi, why aren't you confronting?
No. He would say statements like, "I kiss the hands of the clergy."
Yes.
Because he's supporting them all the way, because that was what needed to be done.
Indeed.
Because they were flying in the face of, as you say, no prayer, no hijab. And even saying that the morning ceremonies of Ashura were going to be stopped or banned, which, you know, Ayatollah Mordaris made a huge demonstration in Qom in the face of that, and that was reversed. You know, they couldn't implement those things, you know, which were, you know, that in the deep psyche of the people. You know, that really, you know, that when you say things like that, you know, no matter how bad a Shia is, you know, he will never, ever say that, you know, I will not go to, you know, the morning ceremonies of Ashura. You know, it's just absolutely impossible. It's so deeply ingrained that it just cannot happen. But as I say...
What we have to understand is these people were themselves also Shias who were trying to do this.
Yeah.
You know, the Shah claimed to be a Shia. What Imam Khomeini tried to bring home to people is that you cannot claim to be a Shia and be confronting Shia values.
Exactly.
This was the fasik that they were trying to confront. Ashura in 1963, the year when... It's interesting because Imam Khomeini gives a very important speech against the Shah, and he compares the Shah to Yazid.
Yes, yes,
And
absolutely.
Quite clearly telling people that he's a Yazid of the time.
Right.
Because he's annihilating Islamic values, yet hypocritically calling himself a Muslim.
Yeah.
You see, and all these things really mounted up in introducing Imam Khomeini to the general public and making them realize that as a religious guide, he also has the want to to develop the socio-political fabric of the Shia community.
That's right.
You know, he's not just purely. Hmm. You know, it's a very interesting statement made by Imam Khomeini in certain discussions relating to political aspirations. He said the Western politics has endeavored to close off the religious participants in society's activities. By saying that you're a religious entity, if you come into social political decision-making process, you're going to spoil your religiousness, stay in the mosque. That one area, kind of looking at the spirituality of a leader.
Well, this is something. Well, in one sense, if we want to be fair here, we want to say that the West will definitely do this as a matter of policy, because they've had a whole history and a whole, since the days of the Enlightenment, a whole philosophy that they have followed through.
That religion and politics should be separate.
It has to be separate in order for their societies to advance. But of course, in the Islamic context, that is completely wrong.
Indeed it is. Because you see, even in their concept is wrong. Mm. Because what they're implying is that a politician can sit and lie to his back teeth and not expect to be penalized because he's a politician. Politics demands lying. This is what the implications
are. That's right, and that's also wrong.
If spirituality comes into the system, you demand that spirituality must also lie.
That's right.
The extension of the primus is this. Mm. But spirituality, when it comes to the system, it's meant to be an annihilator of these liars.
Exactly.
And that's what Imam Khomeini articulated. And that's why you see throughout the movements of the ulema, you've got the tobacco movement by Ayatollah Shirazi, for example.
Shirazi,
and
he
too is taking this on that, you know, the wealth of the Muslim ummah is being taken away by people who are lying to their back teeth that they're representing Islam.
Well, to be honest, Sayyid, I mean, the point is being, you know, very strongly made here that this is what the imperial powers were afraid of. They're afraid of this kind of clergy who has this kind of respect and honor in the hearts of the people, that when, you know, as you say, like Ayatollah Shirazi can turn around and say in a matter of one night that you stop buying tobacco.
Yeah.
Don't smoke it. And all the hookahs that they used to do it, or the pipes they were using, were chucked out into the street. So there we are. I mean, it was this kind of power that they had over the Muslim masses which frightens the imperial powers.
In fact, you see, this is what the British did. Mm. If we look at just a little bit, sidetrack a little bit from and look at the history at that time.
Yes, please do.
That, you know, one of the things that the British Foreign Ministry was investing in was on the Wahhabi movement at that same time.
That's right.
That was
in parallel,
exactly,
as we are talking.
To be a kind of confrontation to the logical Islam that the Shiite and Imam Khomeini's teachings were from the Hawza.
Yeah.
World future in the future going to show. Because the Wahhabi movement was a total downtrodden, ignorant batch of people who came out representing a belief of ideological incompetence, but really an example of what Islam should be.
Mm.
You know, idiots who could not do anything other than burn schools for girls, deprive women from education, taking the whole intellectual thinking of Islam down toward the village level.
Absolutely right, Sayyid. And the thing is that, you know, of course, with this parallel movement which was going on, and, you know, again, the British had the talent for finding these particular people in Najd, which is now known as Ibn Saud. But these particular grouping of people, the main focus of the British policy was to narrow this Islam, you know, to take out the very principles which make the Islamic Ummah dynamic,
exactly,
and active and, you know, progressive.
And the Hawza teaching created that progression.
Sure.
As I said, through Ayatollah Mudarris, as you pointed out, through Ayatollah Shirazi, through Ayatollah Mirza Shirazi, who was the latter person who declared confrontation with the British forces,
sure,
and the British guard, then Imam Khomeini. So, you know, you could see a continuous development.
Thank you for that, Sayyid. Honestly, at this moment in time, listeners, you know, we're getting to the stage where we're talking about the dynamism and the progressiveness of, you know, the movement, particularly here by the Hawza. But we'll discuss this in further depth in the next program. So thank you very much for listening today. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
Around the World with Reporters.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as President of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016, and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years. How to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. And this is like, unless of course there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless of course there's pressure from the left, like I said, the role of labor, to actually pressure to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems.
If we're not talking about enacting changes that could improve the quality of life immediately, materially for working people, and I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about, like, Biden is talking about return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Asarullah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurist policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansarullah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. It calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation.
The American decision and designation was not surprising to us, as it came at the culmination of the U.S. hostilities against the Yemenis, ongoing on for 6 years by two succeeding American administrations. The American administration is the one who is committing acts of terrorism against the Yemenis, and if it reflects negatively on the Yemeni people, there will certainly be a response determined by the leadership.
The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students, who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sa'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansarullah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansarullah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country. Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement is an unacceptable move prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
In July 2020, following the enforcement of new national security laws on Hong Kong by China, the UK announced plans to expand visa rights to Hong Kong residents who claimed British National Overseas or BNO status before Britain handed over its former colony in 1997. Until recently, BNO passports did not give Hong Kong citizens the right of residence in the UK, but Number 10 has now changed the rules.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain, with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship. And that is precisely what we will do now.
China and Hong Kong both say this violates the Sino-British Declaration that paves the way for Hong Kong to return to Chinese rule. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam says the BNO is a form of travel document, not a form of nationality.
If one side, and that is the UK government, tries to deviate from that mutual understanding and bilateral agreement, then of course it's legitimate for the other side, that is the Central People's Government, to consider any countermeasures. And the Hong Kong SAR government will, of course, support any countermeasures to be adopted by the Central People's Government.
UK-China relations deteriorated in 2020. The UK banned Chinese telecom giant Huawei from the build-out of the UK's 5G network. It put forward a proposal to screen and block certain mergers and acquisitions from Chinese investors on national security grounds. And as a former colonial power decided to throw its weight around, declaring China's national security laws on Hong Kong to be a breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. On this pretext, Number 10 is offering almost three quarters of Hong Kong's population a fast-track route to British citizenship, stoking fears of brain drain in the city, especially in its healthcare system. England alone has around 50,000 vacancies for registered nurses, and the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown the NHS's staffing crisis into stark relief. Brexit has made sourcing health professionals from Europe much more difficult, and strict immigration policies also make recruitment from abroad very challenging. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war games to evaluate the mobility and offense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile offense units of the Army Ground Forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the Mach enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight Mach enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi, JOSC.
Amid the recent growing of coronavirus infections in Israeli jails and the medical negligence of Israeli-Palestinian prisoners' conditions, the Palestinian Legislative Council, along with the Ministry of Palestinian Prisoners, held a press conference to express concerns of the serious condition of the prisoners at Israeli jails. Palestinians demanded an urgent action from the international community to save their life.
Our prisoners are dying inside the Israeli jails as the Israeli regime is practicing a slow death policy against them. The Israeli regime doesn't provide the infected prisoners with the required medical care. The international community should step in to save our prisoners' lives.
According to Palestinian Prisoners Organization, over 250 prisoners are diagnosed with the coronavirus, and the number is expected to rise due to the intentional medical neglect at Israeli jails, as Israel has stalled delivery of the vaccine to the Palestinian prisoners. Palestinians also demanded an international supervision to vaccinate the Palestinian prisoners and make sure they are delivering the required health care.
Palestinian prisoners are facing a serious danger that threatens their lives. Israel is using this virus against our prisoners to put further pressure on them. The coronavirus has already reached number Israeli jails and infected almost 250 Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian sources say over 5,000 Palestinians are currently detained in Israeli jails, mostly with no charge. Palestinian resistance has warned that they won't remain silent and hold Israel responsible for the consequences of neglecting the health condition of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners' issue is among our top priorities, and we will do our best to set our Palestinian inmates free. The resistance holds the Israeli regime responsible for all the consequences of this dangerous move.
Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express their outrage at the detention.
While some 5,000 Palestinian inmates are suffering in Israeli jails amid the coronavirus pandemic, Israel has deprived them from their right to health care. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Quds, the axis of Muslims' unity. This is the theme of the International Webinar of Parliaments Supporting Palestine. Organized by Iran's parliament, the event was attended by parliament speakers and deputy speakers from Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, Indonesia, and other Muslim countries, as well as representatives of Palestine's resistance movements to express their solidarity with Palestinians in their resistance against Israel's occupation. Delegates condemned Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain for their normalization of ties with Israel, calling it a betrayal to the Muslim community.
It's a bitter tragedy to see that Palestinians' houses are demolished on a daily basis. 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are living in a prison-like area, and 5 million members of the Palestinian diaspora are not given their legitimate right to return to their homeland. What's even more tragic is that some Muslim countries have given the seal of approval to Israel's crimes by establishing political and economic ties with the occupying regime.
We call on the parliaments of all Muslim and Arab countries to take serious measures against the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and especially the unwelcome deal of the century that seeks to change the identity of Palestinians and their land.
The Arab-Israeli normalization came as part of outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called deal of the century. The plan, which triggered a storm of condemnations from Palestinians, refers to Jerusalem as Israel's undivided capital and recognizes Israeli sovereignty over large parts of the West Bank. While the controversial deal was championed by Trump, observers say the incoming U.S. administration is not likely to change course on Palestine.
For me as a Palestinian and the previous experience of all American presidents, they are, and especially Biden, he's having a big heritage of literature to support the security of Israelis, and he did nothing when he was the vice president during Obama's time for the Palestinian, except that speech and rhetorics, and we have gained nothing.
Palestinian ambassador to Iran says resistance remains the only way ahead of his people against Israel's occupation, since he believes that the path of dialogue does not work with Israel.
We have to unite our forces to be strong front, and all the Arabs and Islamic world will stand behind us. No other way, because they have proved always that they are not loyal to negotiations or to any other settlement with them.
Although the Arab-Israeli normalization infuriated the Muslim world, commentators say it should not come as a surprise, and it's only a revelation of their long-existing covert ties. This is why they believe the move will not lead to a seismic shift in regional power equations.
Delegates at the webinar underlined that Palestine remains the top priority and the innermost issue of the Muslim world, adding that Israel and its Western supporters have spared no effort in derailing that priority. They called on Muslim countries to stay united, as they believe this is the main counterforce against Israel's expansionist agenda. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
...2021 has so far been miserable for millions of business people and their staff across the 27-country European Union. Lots of outlets are being forced to close their doors to prevent the spread of COVID-19, with only essential retailers allowed to remain open.
You see that we have stricter measures than even a few months ago all around Europe.
Finance ministers from the 19-nation Eurozone have just concluded their first meeting of 2021 and warned that social inequality in the EU has yet to peak. Government and personal debt is rising due to the pandemic. We are reminded that the bloc has pre-existing economic problems. For example, in Greece, youth unemployment was running at almost 50% even before COVID-19 came along.
Do not forget the situation in Italy, where proper tax system is not in place, and France is facing enormous problems of unemployment.
The EU's spending watchdog, the European Court of Auditors, has been examining the bloc's initial response to the pandemic. During an online interview, a spokesperson told us that better cooperation is required.
Indeed, the EU has to learn lessons going forward, or to react better to the COVID crisis, but indeed to pandemics in the future, because pandemics aren't going away. There will be another one in the future.
EU finance ministers say COVID-19 recovery funding needs to be released without delay and spent wisely by member states. Meanwhile, the bloc's crucial vaccination program is being rolled out too slowly, many health experts argue. Because the bloc is still in the middle of a health emergency and the start of a new economic crisis, analysts say the EU's response will not be fully assessed by citizens until the pandemic passes. Based on current information, perhaps their verdict will not be good. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An international rights group says that Israel, as an occupying power, must provide coronavirus vaccines to Palestinians. According to a press release by Human Rights Watch on Sunday, the Israeli authorities should provide COVID-19 vaccines to Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Human Rights Watch regional director Omar Shakir said that while Israel has already vaccinated more than 20% of its citizens, including Jewish settlers in the occupied West Bank, it has not committed to vaccinate Palestinians living in the same occupied territory under its military rule. Israeli authorities had, as of January 14, 2021, provided doses of the vaccine to more than 2 million Israeli citizens. Close to 150,000 coronavirus infections and over 1,500 deaths have been reported in the occupied West Bank and the blockaded Gaza Strip so far.
Article 56 of the 4th Geneva Convention requires Israel as an occupying power to adopt and apply the prophylactic and preventive measures necessary to combat the spread of contagious diseases and epidemics. The provision of COVID-19 vaccine to Palestinians is the duty of the Israeli occupying forces. Israel bears full responsibility for the health and well-being of people under its occupation.
Palestinians have accused the Israeli regime of practicing medical apartheid against them and committing mass human rights violations. Experts say Tel Aviv must end its discriminatory policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing or enjoying health care.
Ban Human Rights Watch.
The statement by Human Rights Watch echoes the position of many international human rights organizations as it exposes the ugly face of the Israeli occupation. It also exposes the grave human rights violation by the Israeli regime, especially violating the health rights of Palestinians. Israel as an occupying power must meet its obligations under international laws and norms.
Human rights groups are expressing alarm over Israel's decision not to vaccinate more than 4.5 million Palestinians living in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, depriving them of their right to health care.
Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Austria extends its third hard lockdown until the 7th of February, announcing a new requirement for everyone to use FFP2 or N95 masks in supermarkets and public transport, and extending the minimum distance rule from 1 to 2 meters. The announcement comes a day after thousands took to the streets of Vienna protesting the COVID restrictions. The right-wing FPÖ party, which supports the protests, expressed anger at the decision, warning that people would no longer understand the necessity for the measures and persist in civil disobedience. Officials maintain that they would do the right thing, notwithstanding how popular it will be.
The results of our consultations over the past few days make us anything but happy and also make us anything but popular.
Studies have now shown that the new virus variant first discovered in the UK has been in Austria earlier than was initially suspected, currently affecting around 10% of positive cases.
If the new variant replaces the current virus as the dominant strain, 5 times more cases of illness and death can be expected.
Austria's health minister says the country is currently in the most difficult phase of the pandemic and that the situation is very challenging, at least for the next 10 weeks till the end of March, when warmer weather and more vaccinations can help improve the situation. Around 600,000 people are expected to be vaccinated by then. The goal is to reach a 7-day incidence of 50 new infections per 100,000 people. That number is currently 130.
But there's light at the end of the tunnel, Austria's Chancellor says. With the vaccination campaign underway, officials expect things to look more normal in April or at the latest in May. Homolesky, Vienna.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The latest building spree in the West Bank is not just illegal and flagrant violation of international law. Wonder what does it mean? But the very existence of the Israeli regime lacks all legitimacy. To be more precise, the Zionist entity is a cancerous tumor in the heart of the Arab Muslim world. and ought to be removed at the earliest from the soil of Palestine. For the sake of peace and stability in the West Asia region, if there is any such term as international law. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Keihan International. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Reports from the usurped land of Palestine say the Gregorian calendar year 2020 that went by saw a record number of new Zionist settlements built in the West Bank River of Jordan on lands seized from the native Arab people. In related news, the UN Secretary General has condemned the Zionist entity's recent plan to construct hundreds of new housing units on Palestinian lands, saying such structures are considered illegal under international law. Antonio Guterres added, "The building by Israel of townships on Palestinian territory occupied since 1967, including East Jerusalem, has no legal validity and constitutes a flagrant violation under international law." Good words indeed, but as toothless as the UN Security Council Resolution number 2334, which for the past 50-plus years has been considered a useless piece of paper by both the Israeli regime and its godfather, the United States of America, which constitutes and continues to award more and more Palestinian and Syrian lands to the illegitimate entity that Britain created in 1948. For the several hundred thousand East European Jews it had illegally settled in Palestine between the two world wars. The latest building spree in the West Bank is not just illegal and flagrant violation of international law. Wonder what does it mean, but the very existence of Israel lacks all legitimacy. To be more precise, the Zionist entity is a cancerous tumor in the heart of the Arab Muslim world and ought to be removed at the earliest from the soil of Palestine for the sake of peace and stability in the West Asia region, if there is any such term as international law. According to the UN Charter, it is the duty of the native people to resist and fight against occupation of their ancestral lands rather than accommodate the occupier and embolden it to encroach upon more lands. In view of this clause, the Palestinian people have the birthright to take up arms against the Zionist regime and continue their struggle till all Zionist settlers, not the original Palestinian Jews, are eradicated from not just the West Bank and eastern parts of Beit al-Muqaddas, but from the every single centimeter of Palestinian soil, and that includes Tel Aviv, Haifa, and all other towns and cities. Irrespective of the current Zionist decision to build some 800 new housing units in the recently confiscated Palestinian lands in the West Bank for Jewish migrants from other parts of the world, or for that matter, the figure given by the UN of more than 600,000 Israelis living in over 230 settlements built since 1967 in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2334, it could be said the entire population of 9 million Israelis is living on usurped land. In other words, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the other Palestinian liberation units have a duty to carry on the campaign till their homeland, stretching from borders of Lebanon in the north to the Sinai in the south and from the River Jordan in the east to the Mediterranean Sea in the west, is empty of every single Zionist. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has rightly called for a referendum to find a peaceful democratic solution for the chronic question of Palestine, which the UN has unfortunately ignored. If this suggestion is prevented from implementation by the US and Western powers, then the Israeli regime will most surely meet a violent end, perhaps similar to the end of the 88-year illegal existence of the Latin Kingdom of Jerusalem in 1187 AD, when a united Muslim force of Kurds, Turks, Arabs, and Iranians liberated Palestinians from European Christian occupation. No amount of treason by ruthless Arab regimes of the spurious states will be able to prevent this eventuality. Meanwhile, let the Israelis continue their building spree of thousands or millions of housing units, which one fine day will indeed return to their rightful owners, the Palestinian people.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, neither flattery nor envy. Well, let's define flattery to begin with. Excessive and insincere praise given especially to further one's own interests. Flattery is defined as praise or compliments, usually exaggerated or false. An example of flattery is a person who's hoping for a raise, telling their boss how great their new haircut looks. Excessive or insincere praise is what's flattery. Excessive, untrue, or insincere praise, exaggerated compliment or attention is referred to as flattery. Flattery is dishonest when used to gain control. It is effective because everyone has insecurities and loves to be told great things about themselves. Isn't that right? So this whole idea of flattering others, this is something discouraged in Islam. This is something that deceives not just the recipient, the doer of the flattery, and people who are witnessing that flattery. This is something that is not appreciated and encouraged in Islam. You shouldn't do flattery. You shouldn't excessively praise anyone, because when they deserve to be praised, you do that praise. But excessive praise is bad for them, bad for you. So, you know, this whole idea of flattery is common in corporate culture today. People all the time, you know, they basically praise their bosses even where they do not deserve to be praised. This excessive praise is something that is motivated for some interests that the doer of the flattery is after. So those personal interests are the reason, the triggers for these flatteries. And this is not the ethos of Islam, and one should not perform them. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing neither flattery nor envy. We said that flattery is bad, you shouldn't do flattery. Now, what is envy? Well, we know that there are some people, certain types of people, because one person envies them, they never praise them, even when they deserve to be praised. Why do they do so? Because of the envy. So what Islam tells us is, don't let this envy grow in your hearts in reference to other believers. What is envy? Envy is a feeling of discontented or resentful longing aroused by someone else's possession, qualities, or luck. Envy is a desire to have a quality, possession, or other desirable things belonging to someone else. Envy is when you want what someone else has, but jealousy is when you're worried someone's trying to take what you have. If you want your neighbor's new convertible, you feel envy. This is why Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, when praise and commendation is more than merited and deserved, it is flattery. And when less than merited, it is either debility, inexpression, or envy. So we have been discouraged from being envious of other believers, other people in general, but, you know, more specifically, other believers. If they have a blessing, if they have something that you like, you should be envious of them. You shouldn't let this feeling of envy grow in your heart. This is one of the spiritual diseases that leads to many other spiritual diseases. So neither envy nor flattery is the way to go in Islam. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsetoday.com. Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.